Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Around 30 years ago, Marty Markowitz, not the politician, fell under the spell of a man named Ike. Ike convinced Marty to cut himself off from his family and his friends and to sign over his assets to Ike's wife and daughters in his will. When Ike came to stay at Marty's house in Southampton on Long Island, Ike slept in the master bedroom and put his own name on the mailbox. Ike even became president of Marty's family business, a textile company. Disturbing behavior to be sure, but more so when I tell you that Ike was Marty's longtime psychiatrist. For many years, Dr. Isaac Hirschkopf, or Ike, has been a successful New York City therapist, and for about 30 years, he was Marty's therapist. And during that time, he managed to gain enormous control over Marty's life, and potentially Marty's fortune as well. Joan O'Sara is an opinion columnist with Bloomberg, and he broke the story in a new podcast from Wondery and Bloomberg called The Shrink Next Door. Joe, welcome to All of It.
Thank you, Charlie. Nice to see you.
So how did you first come onto the story?
I bought a house. It's that simple. In 2010, my wife and I bought a small house in the Hamptons, and we were under the impression that next door there lived a psychiatrist. And there was also this little guy who seemed like the caretaker or the gardener or whatever. And I went to a party next door that seemed to be hosted by the shrink. And I went to, my wife and I over for drinks. And everything seemed normal. And I come back the following year, in 2011, the shrink's disappeared. Where's he gone? And Marty, the little guy, comes over to my house with a woman. And he says, Joe, this is my sister Phyllis. I haven't seen her in 27 years. It's like, oh, I want to know more. Then he tells me that the house next door had never been owned by the psychiatrist, but had actually been owned by him. And then he said, I was never the caretaker. I was his patient.
How did you react when you started to get all these details?
Well, my jaw dropped to the floor. But after I lifted it up, I said, you know, I kind of want to know more. And at that point in Marty's life, he had decided to himself go back and kind of research what had happened to him. So he was in this process of, he's a pack rat. He was in this process of digging through old checks that he had paid to Ike and looking up money that he had spent on the house at Ike's request. And even they had, believe it or not, started a foundation together. So he was looking at how much money he had put in versus how much money Ike had taken out for various things that he wanted to spend it on. And as he was doing his sort of research, I started to think, boy, this is a story I'd like to write or I'd like to research. So I began interviewing Marty as he was researching it himself, and we were kind of learning about it together almost.
What was it about the story that drew you to it that you thought, oh, this is a story we should tell?
A couple of things. First of all, like millions of Americans and certainly millions of New Yorkers, I've had plenty of therapy. And the thought that I would ever turn over my house to my psychiatrist or that he would ask me to start a foundation with him, or it was inconceivable. Therapy takes place in between these four walls. And so just to hear that the psychiatrist had kind of stepped out of the four walls and had consumed this guy's life, I wanted to know more about that. That in and of itself was a story. And then it became the question of, you know, what constitutes unethical behavior? How do you gauge it? What do the psychiatric associations say about it? Why is this guy still practicing if he's done all these things? And these were all the questions that were in my mind as a journalist.
You are listening to All of It. I'm Charlie Herman, filling in for Allison Stewart, and my guest is Joan O'Sara, host of the podcast The Shrink Next Door. What I'm wondering is, what was going on in Marty's life at that time when he first started being treated by Dr. Hirschkopf, by Ike, that he could, I don't know, when you listen to the story, there's a part of you that, I know for myself, I'm like, well, that would never happen to me, or how did that happen?
I agree.
What was it?
First of all, there's two aspects of this that are worth talking about. The first one is that Marty, at that point in his life, was feeling very overwhelmed by life. And he had been put in charge, his parents had just died. And this is the most important part. He had been put in charge suddenly of his family company, which he'd never really assumed was going to happen anytime soon. His uncle had assumed that he was going to get the company. So there was a huge family fight. And then Marty felt like he really felt overwhelmed by running the company. And so he goes to see Ike in the beginning and he says, I have all these problems. And he's feeling unusually vulnerable. And Ike says, don't worry, I can take care of this for you. And Marty has the kind of personality that says, oh, thank you. That's wonderful. And in fact, Ike does take care of some of these problems. I mean, he actually very early on steps out of the psychiatrist role and kind of walks into Marty's office and says, let's do it this way. Let's do it this way. Let's do this. Let's fire this person. And Marty's grateful. There's a second aspect, though, that's, I think, important. Obviously, most people would not put up with that, even if they were feeling overwhelmed. So, you know, I think that certain therapists, certain psychiatrists have the ability to kind of hone in on who's potentially vulnerable and can take advantage of those people. And one of the things we find out in the podcast is that Marty was not the only person that Ike did this to.
I think that was one of the episodes that stood out to me the most. It was called La Familia, where it stepped out to show that there were other people who had been influenced by this as well. And at least for me, felt like, oh, these are people who, that it wasn't just one person, that in a way, this could be anybody actually at a certain point in their life in a certain time. That's one of the lessons.
I don't 100% think it could be anybody, but I do think there are a lot of people. He does this in almost every case with Ike. He does it to people in their 20s who are in a crisis. That's that he sees there's a crisis and he takes advantage of that fact. And you know, just for the record, I met a lot of people who said Ike helped them, and I met a lot of people who said, yeah, I know some strange things went on. We would have our therapy sessions at the Four Seasons, which I, but he helped me. And, you know, I learned how to deal with people. He was really good at that. And I learned how to handle certain situations. He was really good at that. So some people understood how to take advantage of his skills without turning over their lives to him, and others didn't.
So what was the first warning sign in a way that this was probably not going to be a typical patient-psychiatrist relationship as you were doing your reporting?
Well, one of the things I've come to learn, although I sort of knew it before, is therapy needs to take place in the therapist's office. And that even a well-meaning therapist who steps outside that role and into the real life of a patient is not helping the patient.
You're becoming too involved.
You're helping behavior that isn't all that good. So to me, the first warning sign is when Ike says to Marty, "Let me come down to your office and take a look at it." So they go to the office, and Ike immediately, as you see in the podcast, says something like, "The door." If you're going to be the boss, the door should always swing in and it should never swing out. I may have that backwards. He said there was some psychiatric rationale
about the way the door moves.
And that should have been a huge flag that Ike was, even though he was trying to be helpful at that point in Marty's life, that should have been a huge flag for anybody in therapy. If the therapist says, you know, let's go to your office, you shouldn't do it. There's another woman.
And that becomes a point in Marty's life and in the podcast. We have to remember these are real events where Ike began to take on a role within the company, not just giving suggestions about what to do about the door, but actually became a president of the organization.
It should note that he still charged Marty by the hour. But he had the title of president, and he viewed himself as the tough guy who did the tough things that Marty couldn't bring himself to do. Now I also, talking about the office, there's a character in the podcast called Emily, not a real name. And Emily says, you know, Ike, she says, when Ike first came to my office, she said, I thought to myself, oh my God, he cares so much that he's willing to come to my office. That's the kind of thinking that can get you in trouble. Instead of saying, he came to my office, oh my goodness, therapist shouldn't do that.
Right, right. A lot of the drama actually takes place at Marty's house in the Hamptons. And how, and Ike, in a way, began to start taking control of that property. How did that happen?
Ike and his family started to visit Marty at a property that he owned. And then they discovered that the adjoining property was up for sale. Ike found that out, and he told Marty, you know, go buy it. Go buy it. So Marty buys it, so this is basically an empty house. And that's the point at which, according to Marty, Ike basically takes over the master bedroom, takes over the house. Marty goes to the guest quarters. And one of the amazing things about the house that I discovered when I went there for the first time is it's just chock-a-block with photographs of Ike with Henry Kissinger, Eli Wiesel, Brooke Shields, Tracy Austin, the tennis star, on and on and on and on and on.
And didn't they even take your picture when you were there?
He did. It was a weird thing. He said, you know, we're finishing our drinks, and he says, Joe, I want to take your picture. And it's like, huh? And, you know, I was trying to be a polite neighbor, so I let him take my picture, and I suspect if he had maintained the house, my picture would have been on the wall at some point.
My guest again is Joan O'Sara, who writes for Bloomberg and is also the host of the podcast, The Shrink Next Door, from Bloomberg and Wondery. What was it that Ike wanted? What do you believe Ike may have wanted out of this relationship? Because at one point, Marty left the Hamptons property to his wife. What was it? Was it money, from what you can tell?
It's really hard to say. I mean, Ike, in his vehement defenses, you know, has basically said, if I had wanted his money, I could have taken it, but I didn't. And he says, you know, I would have we would have sold the house immediately and put the money in the foundation.
This is a foundation that was created by the two of them.
The closest that I could come to it comes from his stepsister.
This would be Ike's stepsister.
Ike's stepsister, Sybil, who, by the way, is probably the youngest person to have survived Auschwitz. You know, both of Ike's parents survived Auschwitz, as did his stepsister. She was 4 years old when the war ended. Anyway, she's 78 now, and we called her up and we asked her, you know, why did Ike want to be a psychiatrist? And she said, well, because it gives him power over people. And that's the closest that I can come to understanding the motivation.
In your opinion, what was the most objectionable thing that you saw or that you believe Ike may have done in his interactions with Marty?
It's really hard to say. I would say the thing that I found myself sort of startled by more than anything is the fact that they would have their session, and then they would walk to Marty's office, and then Marty would start typing Ike's correspondence and sometimes his novels, which he wrote a series of, and Ike was charging him for this. I mean, he was on the clock.
That Ike was charging him for the benefit of writing, right, of retyping his
right,
novels.
And of all the things I couldn't understand why Marty would put up with, it's like, you know, I would ask him, Marty, you know, why did you do this? And he said, at first he said, well, in the beginning, I thought I was helping a great man. That's what I felt, a man I greatly admired. But then over time, he began to feel more and more used because, you know, he was spending so much time typing Ike's manuscripts. And as much as any single thing, that's what caused him to finally break away.
I was going to say, what in your opinion is the thing that finally led Marty, after almost 30 years of giving up a lot of control of his entire life, his friends, his family, to have Ike be that one person? What was it that finally gave Marty the impetus and the ability to say, you know, enough?
The company, it's a small company, and it was dwindling because the Chinese were taking over the fabric business, you know, so it was getting smaller and smaller, and it was losing money. And it was in Midtown Manhattan, and the rent was insane. And he was telling Ike, I have to move, because if we don't move, we're going to go broke. And I kept resisting and resisting. And finally, Marty just said, I'm going to move. And he moved the company to New Jersey. And he did it on his own without Ike. And that's the moment where I feel like he almost snapped to attention and said, you know, why am I depending on this guy? Why am I paying this guy when I just made the single most sensible move I could have made for the business by myself? And then once he moved to New Jersey, you know, he was much further away from Ike, and their meetings became less frequent. And then he had an operation, and Ike never called him. So he felt, you know, and so at that point, you know, he had broken the cord.
Now, many years ago, when you first learned about the story, you were in touch with Dr. Hirschkopf for the story.
I was.
And how did he react to you when you first contacted him? And what has been his response to this podcast?
Let me just say, I do not know what his response to the podcast has been, because I don't have any access to his thinking or his friends.
What is when you would put questions to him, how did he respond to the accusations or the description of what Marty said happened?
So when I was first reporting this in 2012 and 2013, he sent me several extraordinarily lengthy single-spaced emails defending himself and also really attacking Marty. You know, if, you know, Marty killed animals in his backyard, Marty ate Haagen-Dazs every night, even though I told him not to, and that's why he had a heart attack. I mean, it was just on and on and on. And attacking me also, you know, just for various you know, things that I had done, you know. But I did interview him, and you know,
You interviewed him many, many years ago.
Yeah, many, many years ago. And he was very adamant about that he had done nothing wrong. So what he basically says is, I never slept with a patient. I never took anything beyond a professional hourly fee. Therefore, I haven't violated the ethics of my profession. We have, you know, what we talked to one of the preeminent ethicists in the profession, a guy named Dr. Glenn Gabbert, who basically said, no, that's not right, that much of what you're describing, although he didn't talk about Ike specifically, definitely constitutes what they call boundary violations. You cross the bounds of the profession into a realm that's not ethical.
And where do things stand with him right now as a psychiatrist?
He's got a practice.
Marty
has had a complaint in with the New York Board of Health, which is a licensing agency, which has the ability to pull his license. And there, since the podcast has come out, there's been some movement, but it's really hard to know what they will do and when they will do it.
And what I'm wondering is, this is a step back from the specifics of this story. What has this whole experience been like for you? I mean, you've been a longtime print journalist. You're at the New York Times. You've been a business reporter, columnist. You've done op-eds. You've written about sports. And now here you are doing what the kids these days are doing. You're putting out a podcast. How has this all been for you?
It's been a gas. I love it. It's really been fun. I when you're a writer, you collaborate with one person, an editor, and that usually doesn't take place until after you've finished writing. With the podcast, you're collaborating with a whole team of people, an audio producer, some editors, some people at Wondery, the production company, really good people at Bloomberg. And there's a side of me that really loves to collaborate. I also learned a ton about writing for this
thing called audio.
Yeah, it's different. It's really different. And even a magazine story where you're really thinking a lot about structure and keeping people on the edge of their seats and starting sections and stopping, even that pales compared to the amount of thought that goes into how do you structure an episode of a podcast. So I have found it to be a very gratifying experience, and I have found it to be a real learning experience, and I'm hoping Bloomberg lets me do it again.
What, in terms of the specifics of the story in the podcast, where do things stand? Does your reporting continue on? Are you hearing from more people?
We have heard, as we mentioned in an update episode, we've heard from a few people. I can't talk about it that more right now. But we are waiting to see what the Department of Health does. And when they do whatever they're going to do, we will do an updated an updated episode.
Do you get a sense? I mean, this is a story in the end about these two individuals, and in particular about Marty and his experience. But when you've come to the end of it now, do you see something maybe larger about the human experience that you take away? Or is this just a great story about one individual person's experience and what happened to him? Or do you have, you see these bigger themes out of it?
Well, the bigger theme is a small... I do see a bigger theme, but it's not that big. It's not the human experience necessarily, but it is the therapeutic experience. It's you know, this is not the only time this has ever happened. There's a famous example in the late 70s and mid 80s of Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys having his life taken over by a psychologist named Eugene Landy. Hmm. Who had him under 24-hour surveillance, who would not allow him to talk to anybody, including the other Beach Boys, who put his name on Brian's music that he wrote at that time, and so on and so forth. He eventually lost his license. There's a movie, Love and da-da-da-da-da, you'll think of it, because you're that kind of guy, Charlie.
Do what I can.
Love and... Anyway, there's a movie about
Mercy?
It. Yes, Love and Mercy. Very good.
I got to give credit to our producer on that one. I can't claim credit for that, but please go ahead.
Paul Giamatti plays the psychologist. Anyway, this is something that is an ongoing issue in therapy. We had a woman on episode 7, the update episode, who runs a therapy help group, who talked a lot about how it works and how people are groomed and what to look for. And so I think the larger message is not necessarily the human experience, but a person with that much power over a vulnerable person can take advantage of them if they so choose, if they decide to go that route. Luckily, most of them don't, but some of them do.
Is that something to be worried about, therapy?
Yes, it's something to think about. It's something to be aware of. You know, if you're...
But it wouldn't turn you off of therapy.
Oh, not at all. I mean, it's no secret that I've suffered from depression. I wrote about it a year ago. And I have said, I'm on record as basically saying, you know, the combination of my psychiatrist giving me meds, putting me on the right meds, and my psychologist with talk therapy saved my life. I mean, didn't save my life exactly, but, you know, they brought me back to life. And I'm very grateful, and I'm a total believer in therapy. But if my therapist ever said, hey, let's meet at your office or let's have lunch, I would dump him immediately.
My guest has been journalist and author Joe Nocera, talking about his new podcast, The Shrink Next Door. Joe, thank you so much for joining all of it.
Thank you, Charlie.
Coming up next, it's time to check in with WQXR's creative director Clemency Burton Hill for this week's All Things Classical. More after the break. Stay with us.